This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're revisiting what has become one of my favorite themes to visit here on the podcast, and that is mental health during the holidays. It's something that I think is hugely relatable, very under-discussed, and yet prevalent as hell. The pressures on us that we get into in this episode, I think everyone will feel in some way or other. Also, it is not lost on me that I'm recording this on a very warm day, unseasonably warm. It's currently the 10th of October, and I don't think it's been announced that we're having a heat wave here in Ireland, but something is going on. It is very, like, I'm here sweating like it's an interview in the middle of summer. And I'm finding joy in that because recently, as of me speaking to you now, but not recently by the time you hear this, we made the announcement about the show going to every other week. And it's lovely to, you know, to see that already that's helpful in terms of my own experience of burnout, but it's also so great to be recording ahead of time like this, to be so ahead of schedule. I'm finding it really fulfilling, and I think, you know, the pressure being off gives me more perspective. Does that make sense? I think, you know, sometimes we can get so stuck in task to task, and so I'm nearly feeling my own brain, if that makes any kind of sense, sort of slow down and broaden out what I'm looking at, you know, not just kind of getting task. And today's guest, Dr. Elizabeth Easton, is a clinical psychologist who works in the States and has an incredible private practice in addition to other lines of work you'll hear her talk about. In really one of the professionals who I've heard has the most specialisms. You know, she specializes in family therapy, but also eating disorders, psychedelics. We talk about, particularly behind the paywall, we have a really impactful conversation about that and about when you know if it might be the right time, or, you know, how to kind of approach that evolving newer area of mental health with appropriate kind of understanding and caution, but also some of the benefits that can be there. So yeah. I hear myself record these all the time and be like, we covered a lot. It's one of my fucking phrases I can't stop saying. But it has never been more true than a conversation like this one. So with that all said, happy festive season, whatever you celebrate. And equally, if you don't, coming from someone that does every single thing to avoid New Year's celebrations and either make sure I'm working or I'm hunkering down at home with loads of snacks. So if there's one thing you take away from this episode, you are far, far, far from alone in finding this a stressful time. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Easton. When I think about an early experience that I had with mental health, it's actually an experience that I just spoke to my mom about yesterday. Remembering being in my room as a young child and hearing my parents argue, hearing their conflict, and feeling that sense of trying to disconnect from the space around me and trying to disconnect from what I felt inside of myself, but noticing this like rattling inside of my body. And you know, I can now today name that as my first moments of really feeling anxiety and feeling what anxiety feels like in the body and both being absorbed by it and wanting to run from it all at the same time. But just that early experience of seeing how my parents' mental health individually and together as a couple affected my health as a young child. And so a lot of my work has been about, personal work has been about understanding how my nervous system works and how to not disconnect from it, how to come towards it and be with it. And then also how family environments and relationships can affect so much from a young age all through the rest of your life. And so I sought out being a family therapist in high school I think because of those early experiences of really wanting to understand how does family make an impact that could be negative, but also it can be your way out. You know, having those kinds of conversations, talking about those things together, that connection can be really profound and really healing. So that's a little bit about me.
Absolutely. I appreciate you sharing that. And, you know, I really got the visual there of that environment of what you were dealing with and that natural inclination to want to zone out from, you know, a stressful situation and maybe even just the noise of the arguing and your whole body kind of retreating from that. Did you know what that was?
No, I don't think I knew what the emotion was, but I recognized that I had a lot of stomach aches and headaches as a kid. And so I think I would feel discomfort in my body. I'd feel stomach aches or cramps and I'd feel headaches. And so I knew that something was wrong, but it was much later that I was able to start looking back at that and saying, oh, those were signs of anxiety. And that's, as a young kid, what you can kind of connect with of, you know, a stomach ache as opposed to high cortisol levels and your nervous system being overwhelmed. So I think I always wanted to know. I always wanted to try to understand what was happening, which probably got me to where I am today.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, often you're right. It's those physical symptoms that we notice and can nudge us towards change in a lot of situations. And I do wonder sometimes if that's because that's maybe what we're more predisposed to notice and act on and understand, or if sometimes, you know, it feels like those are the only symptoms because we just can't contemplate the internal emotional world. And so it's, you know, easier or automatic to be like, okay, a stomach ache, what do I do? Do I take a tablet? Do I go to the doctor? What's the action I take on this physical thing that I can easier describe?
And our society kind of conditions us to that too, right? Like, oh, if you're overwhelmed, that's not a good reason to miss work. But, oh, if you have physical symptoms, of course you're not expected to work. Well, hopefully that's the environment you work in. And so we're really conditioned as a society. You know, my parents were conditioned. My mom was literally a pediatric nurse, conditioned to listen to physical symptoms and take those seriously or search for solutions. But we're not really taught from an early age of, oh, that thing you're feeling, that could also be because you're nervous or you're scared or you're sad or, you know, you're angry. You know, we're not, those things aren't labeled for us, you know, as kids. And so we focus in on, well, where is the pain and describing it physically instead of emotionally.
Mm-hmm. And so as you got older then, what sort of other ways did you notice that family dynamic influence you?
My dad saw an interview on TV about adult attention deficit disorder, ADHD. It was like a mirror. He realized that he had been suffering with ADHD most of his life. And not really suffering with ADHD, because I see it as a really beautiful neurodiversity, but suffering, having his brain work that way in a society, in a world that doesn't celebrate it and that doesn't function in that way. So suffering with some of the shame and frustration, you know, that comes from that mismatch. So he ended up seeking care and getting a diagnosis and learning more about it. My brother then was diagnosed and they helped him gain a better understanding. And so I think the empathy towards himself and then the compassion from my mom and, you know, all of us better understanding what was happening for him that was then also happening in our home. It was kind of a turning point, I think, for not only for us to look at ourselves and talk about it, but for us to really work together to support each other and just speak more openly about what we needed. So that sounds, you know, so beautifully healthy. It wasn't always. It was very messy and still is in some ways, like we tend to be as humans. But I remember that's when I started to get really curious about psychology, human behavior, human emotion, relationships, and their impact.
Absolutely. And, you know, if that's something that hopefully comes through with the work I do, it's that mental health is a global responsibility. So ADHD, we've talked about recently on the show. And, you know, as more people are understanding it and realizing just how much more prevalent that condition is than we thought, there's increasing questions about how much of that is something that we can view as a helpful difference, like you described, like a superpower. But part of that will be nudging towards a world that people can make the most of that.
Yeah. Where it can be celebrated, where it is a superpower, where we can stop calling it a disorder. You know, I think starting there, seeing it as neurodiversity and not as a something that puts them in disorder, but it is order for them, how their brains work. But our society doesn't celebrate that and isn't set up for that to go well for them in many ways.
Yeah. And I think all of us can find parallels to this that we would be familiar with, right? So if it's not ADHD, it might be something else. Like for me, dyslexia is one. Or, you know, going further than that, maybe you look at other forms of discrimination that can come up, like discrimination based on race. And then you wonder, well, is that to do with actual real differences? Or is that the way people are racialized as being different? They're described as us being divided by race and being treated differently on the basis of that. People having sexuality discrimination. Yeah. Is that to do with just internalized stuff that can make you feel lesser? Well, then where does that internalized stuff come from? It has to be somewhere you internalized it from.
Yeah. You probably weren't just born with that. You were born into a community, into a society, into relationships that carried that, whether it was external and overt or internal, and just this bias carried within them that came out in these small ways. But I think that all of that needs to be explored, and that constant curiosity is essential.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so while we're exploring very broad strokes before we get on to our main theme today, I'm interested in your thoughts of it being such a common experience that people get into a field like yours with lived experience. And, you know, sometimes I hear stigmatizing pushback there. You know, people might see it as you're in the field because of your stuff, as opposed to help people. You can imagine what I think of that, but you go ahead.
There's this quote, I think it's by Ram Dass, of we're all walking each other home. And I think that's really what I've come to at this point in my career. I think early on, I thought, well, yeah, I had my stuff and I need to look at it and I need to, you know, quote unquote, fix it or kind of package it up and make sure it all looks good in order to be able to go help people, in order to be, you know, capable. And then I'm the expert in the room. And man, very quickly was I schooled around that every time I work with anyone, it's going to potentially bring more layers up for me about myself and my own history. And so I see it all happening in parallel or in tandem with each other, at least for it to be done in a really, truly supportive human-to-human contact kind of way. And so I'm of the bent of we as therapists, as supporters, as healers, it is just as important, if not most important, for us to do our own work and for it to not end, for it to continue. And so I have sought that out in a variety of different ways. I don't think I do a psychotherapy training where I don't first say, okay, if I was to receive this, you know, what are the areas I need to look at for myself so that I can be really attuned in supporting others with it? So I think it's essential that we just look at our own humanness and bring towards that curiosity and compassion.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I can certainly speak for myself. There's something appealing about having a counselor with skin in the game. You know, if anything, for me, that's a plus to be like, there's certain things you get firsthand, and maybe the sort of, I don't know if reverence is the right word, but the severe importance I put on mental health is very much informed by my lived experience. And, you know, I think there's a particular appreciation, but then equally there's another argument there that if we examine ourselves in depth, like you will have done through your training, we can all find something.
Oh, absolutely.
Probably a whole load of things.
Absolutely. As well as some really beautiful strengths and, you know, protective mechanisms that have kept us safe. And, you know, just I think it's the exploration of all of it that we can really find. And that's why I'm so passionate about the work. It can be so liberating to see the wounds and work on healing from the wounds or see how you've been managing the wounds. So I think it's all really inspiring work. And that's why I keep coming back to it.
And while you were training yourself, were there ever times when you paused and wondered if this was something you were capable of?
You know, I think there were two layers of me. One was the perfectionist that thought that you've made it when you have all of the things, the degree and the certifications and, you know, the experience to put on the resume. And I think that part of me was quietly in self-doubt for a long time. But there's this other internal part of me, you know, true self, that always knew this was the work I was meant to do. And I'm just lucky to have figured it out in high school and continued to work with it, that this is really where a lot of my gifts lie. So if I can stay out of that ego a little bit of what it's supposed to look like and, you know, feedback from other people around all of that, then I can stand really strong in this place of like, yeah, this is the work. And when it rattles me, yeah, that's because it's the work. You know, that's how I continue to grow. So I can say at this point in my career, it doesn't happen as often.
Yeah, but I think sometimes that's how you know you're onto something really important.
You're really important.
You know,
something
and like
to teach you a lot.
Yeah. I would generally be of the mentality that the big jobs, the ones that are really for us, are kind of intimidating, you know, because they are the ones that are going to stretch us.
They're going to knock you off your base a little bit, and you're going to have to either get back on your base or create a new one. And I think that's what I've done time and time again. I've been a psychologist, I think, for 16 years now. And I'd say every few years, it's okay, what can I still integrate and stand on? And what's new that's going to leave me a little more shaky that I can reach towards? I think it's a good metaphor for just life in general, but it's helpful to use it for my career as well.
Mm-hmm. That's great to hear. And so as we move on to our theme today, so mental health during the holidays, would you mind sharing some kind of broad brush strokes of what things you see come up for your clients around this time of year?
Yeah, I think the first piece is this perception of what the holidays are supposed to be. So this pressure of it's a very magical, memorable, special time, and everyone is supposed to be happy and be super flexible and capable and be their best selves. And I mean, the pressure of that alone is going to leave people to not show up as their best selves. And so that's one piece. And then this additional layer of a lot of social activities, a lot of engaging with people that you may not see very often, and trying to rework kind of that, how those relationships work and how that communication works. And then, I think for many people, there's also this pressure of whether you struggle with eating and body image issues or not. Across the board, there's this continuum of it's all about the food, but also don't restrain yourself, not too much. And you know, oh, I gained weight during the holidays, and what does that mean? And then you turn into the new year, and it's, oh, you're supposed to get to the gym. And you're like, there's so many messages about who we're supposed to be, what we're supposed to be. I think it's kind of a pressure cooker period of time. So that's what I hear most from the clients that I work with, but even just people in my life. Oh, man, it's the holidays, and it's this very bittersweet time.
Yeah. No, I absolutely relate to that and see that in a lot of people around me, that distinct pressure of it's the most wonderful time of the year, which sounds lovely, but does carry a weight to it, an expectation, and yeah, a pressure to meet that. And, you know, I think particularly if you're already struggling with your mental health, or if it's a time of year that you can already find difficult, then that's often when, you know, the masking behaviors come in. And the, yeah, you know, the feeling of, okay, should I be pretending to be happy, to be, mm-hmm, you know, living my best life, having the best time of the year, when, you know, it's not always the case. We're out of our usual routine. We're maybe not in our usual home. We're, like, mm-hmm, you said, interacting with people. We were saying off air, you know, being back in your family home can be its own thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, and how much you give into or resist that dynamic.
Yeah, I think the other piece that I didn't mention that is very present for me in my own home is also a sense of loss of who is not able to be there. And maybe because you actually lost that loved one, maybe the relationship is strained and it's not what it used to be or what you could imagine it be in your head. And so I do think that there could be grief and loss that is very prominent during the holidays as well, that we often don't speak to. You might see it in a Hallmark movie, but we don't speak to it very much.
It's true. And also, you know, you've got me thinking about, like, there is it goes beyond the masking. There is a lot of just playing pretend in general, you know, that everyone's running around feverishly, trying to get all the gifts ready, trying to get all the food in the house and any other kind of preparations you would do, decorations, etc. And then you get to the particular days themselves where it's like, okay, and now suddenly we're all meant to be magically relaxed.
Yeah.
And having such a lovely time and everything's very easy, even though maybe certain members of the family are having to cook everything and other people are sitting and watching the TV.
Right. But actually you get to that period of time and the best way to respond to what's happened leading up to it is nap time. Everybody goes into nap time for several hours. And that would be the best way to truly respond to what had just happened. But instead, you're hosting, you're engaging, you're chatting, you're, you know, mentally thinking through landmines and conversations. I mean, it's a lot.
And so what sort of conversations would you be having with clients leading up to this time of year?
You know, I think I usually start with, let's just notice what is happening within you. So that could be your physical body, that could be emotionally, that could be what is your brain ruminating or planning or thinking about, but just generally strategies to connect to self and to notice where maybe in day-to-day life outside of the holidays, that's hard, and how going into the holidays, it can be even harder to not only get connected, but stay connected to yourself, to your needs, to your experience. So just doing a lot of preparation around, you know, let's start with doing some even small mindfulness activities every day just to keep that connection strong. So then when you get into the situation, you can use those strategies a little easier. So that could be like little meditations or breath work or even like body tensing and relaxing, that kind of stuff. But then ultimately getting to a place of true self-validation. It's okay that I feel this way. It's okay that this is my experience. It's valid. And these are my needs that come from it. And so a lot of work starting there of just giving them a space to explore that.
Yeah. And I think that often comes up when we talk about this theme on the podcast. It's validating, like, if you're listening to this, you are far, far from the only one that finds this time stressful. You know, that is a nice place to start. And then from there, you know, what can you do about it? What practically? So a few things I know have been helpful for me have been to your piece of sort of staying connected with yourself. Some of that is, yes, checking in, but some of that is also the support of friends. Scheduling that time in. So it's not all family time. There's still phone calls with friends or, you know, this year, for example, I'll be in Edinburgh and I have, you know, enough friends around that city that I can catch up with and we can, you know, go for a coffee and do what we would normally do the rest of the year and just get that bit of normality and I'm my usual day-to-day self with them.
Yeah, and that idea of routine, you know, like I get up in the morning and I do this, or usually in the afternoon, I'd have a chat with this person, or, you know, keeping some sense of routine, both with what you do with yourself, what you do with other people in your life. And it can keep you from that potential trap of like turning into who you were or who you have been in some of your family relationships. So noticing when that pull comes up and being aware of what that is, and also being able to step out of that and have the experience of being with people in your life now. So I think that's hugely important. Who can you phone, even if you don't talk about what you're stressed out about? You could just talk about life in general, but that brings you some peace and connection.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Keep doing that.
I know. Now I need to give you some more. So another one I do, this one's sillier, but I love it. I have my little rituals. And one of them that springs to mind is I watch an animated, like, short TV show every year at Christmas called The Gruffalo. And it's based on a children's book. And the animation is very cute. And it has loads of famous voices you'd recognize in it. And so, yeah, every year I watch that. And I don't know why I started it. But one year I watched it and was like, oh, this is fun. Maybe I'll do it next year. And now I do it every year. And it's like, as quaint as it might seem that I watch a little children's animation, it's actually one of a few things that they're my rituals that are easy for me to, I guess, complete and a part of my Christmas and don't rely on anyone else fitting into a schedule or, you know, being in a good mood or, you know, anything. It's just something that I can do at my own leisure. And that's my part of Christmas. And the same way as, like, I'm the person in my family that tends to eat most of the selection boxes we get gifted. Or, you know, I'm the person that, what else do I do? What does that say? There are two things that come to mind, TV and chocolate, but I guess that is all of it's Christmas.
That sounds like the holiday.
But yeah, there's different little things like that. I get really into candles every Christmas as well.
Yeah, I think there's something, and you just kind of spoke to it, of like, what do I hope to get out of the holidays? What do I hope to get out of this experience? Either the holiday in general or like specifically this interaction. And setting that intention before going in and maybe even putting some boundaries up around being able to accomplish that, like flexible boundaries where if you need to shift them, you can shift them. But, you know, sometimes we get so swept up in what other people want and what other people need or what's supposed to happen that we forget, oh, wait, the holiday's for me too. And there are certain like rituals, certain things that I do to really connect to this and feel this. Yeah, I watch a certain movie every year when I'm wrapping gifts and I do it all by myself. And it's one of my favorite parts of the year. And then like with others, there are certain little rituals that we do. And then there's that flexibility of letting those continue to shift and grow. You know, I have a 9-year-old son and just having him contribute to what our rituals will become has been really important. So not to hold on to them too tightly, but also not to let them completely go. Kind of finding that balance.
Mm-hmm. And I love the boundaries element. I agree, is so important. Like, you've reminded me of another one of mine is I don't like shopping with other people at Christmas. I like doing it on my own. And part of that is, you know, I'll have a lot of things to buy and I'm often, you know, not at home for, you know, my home for Christmas. So it's okay, you know, I need to purchase a lot of things in a short space of time while I'm in a different city. But then also it's chaos. Like, I have an efficiency in general on my own that if you're trailing around half your relatives, that goes completely out the window. And, you Absolutely. Know, and that's fine too. You know, you get the present buying done however you need to, and then they'll all be happy for it when they get the presents.
You know, and I think it's okay for people to ask you about those boundaries. Like, hey, is there a reason you always do this by yourself? And for you to take a minute and go, yeah, there is actually. Like, this is what I get from doing it on my own. But also being curious about other people's boundaries. You know, sometimes we get really frustrated and we're like, why do they have to do it like this? Or why does it have to be like this? And instead of railing against the boundary, coming towards it with like, hey, tell me, what does this mean to you? Or what would happen if what didn't look like this? And be truly curious about how they answer it. Because it may lead to some meaning for them around what they need to get out of the holiday. So I think it's both what we do with ourselves and also how we come towards the people in our life during those times.
And earlier you mentioned food, the pressures around having all of it, the pressures around what you have to do to make up for having all of it in January. Yeah. And would you have any particular advice on navigating that?
Yeah, you know, I think first and foremost, just be aware of all of the media perspectives around it, social media, TV, movies, just also what our societies say is good food, bad food, what they say about the idea of weight fluctuating at different times of the year. You know, I think it's just be a mindful consumer of all of that and notice what feels true and in line for you and what doesn't. And, you know, I think there is this double-edged sword of, you know, you need to enjoy it and you need to appreciate it. And then you need to feel guilty about enjoying it and indulging. And it's just so unhelpful. It's so much static. And so ultimately just paying attention to, do I want that? And can I mindfully enjoy it and take it in as satisfying and pleasurable? And know when I've had enough, but also notice when maybe the guilt or the shame or the discomfort arises afterwards and coming towards that with love. You know, oh, this is partly mine, partly not. And did I enjoy that? Was that important to me? Okay, then it was great. And see if you can let go of some of those messages that aren't yours, some of those thoughts that aren't yours. And if you continue to get really stuck in that and you notice those patterns are really overwhelming, that could be something really longstanding that's worth going to look at and seeking more support with a therapist or even starting to talk with friends about it. But that it's often a pattern during the holidays that people can notice and realize, oh, I've been doing this my whole life. I can't indulge in something pleasurable without feeling guilt after. And that can really steal your joy and your health. And so it is a time where a lot of people come and start meeting with me after the holiday because they realize that something was glaring that they think is not just about that period of time, but is there for them pretty consistently.
Yeah, yeah. I relate to that a lot. If there's one thing we're good at in this country, it is guilt related to pleasure. Like anything that might be fun or good, it's possible to feel guilty about. So yeah, spot on. And so tell me, what about then if that pressure, those messages and expectations around food or around weight are coming from the people around you?
Yeah, yeah. It's probably the most common reason people come to me is this frustration or even shame after interactions with loved ones around the holidays around it. And, you know, I think to start with just noticing again what feels like yours and what feels like theirs. And there's kind of two parts of that. For some people, a lot of time is spent on just trying to unpack that. This is what I think about food and body and weight and all of these things and exercise. Versus these are the messages that are being given to me by media and family and sometimes intergenerational messages. So my mom and I have even talked about this, of the pressure. I am a quarter Lebanese, so Middle Eastern. And my grandfather had very specific messages given to him and his society coming over around like what is beautiful. And so then those messages were handed down to my mom and her sisters. And then she noticed what messages she was handing down to me. And so then I start to become an eating disorder specialist and having these conversations with my mom. And she's realizing, oh, this has been generations and generations of what is beautiful and what is okay. And so some of it's just unpacking that and recognizing that in your own family. So I could sit here and just be angry that my mom taught me that if I eat that candy bar, it's going to go straight to my hips, which is a quote I will never forget from when I was little. Yeah. But then I, having these conversations with her, like saying, why do you think that? You know, where did that come from? And realizing, oh, that was told to her and then reinforced in our society. And so like, okay, we all come at this honestly, you know, and the same kinds of messages. Yeah.
No, that's powerful because, you know, I've got to experience that firsthand, that sometimes the biggest question can be, what do you mean by that? You know, that can really stop somebody in their tracks when they're in these kind of automatic feedback loops that they may not be aware of. And, you know, certainly in my own kind of mental health journey, that's been really helpful to, you know, not in a judgmental way, but to observe when people are in these loops and see that that's theirs and that they're doing their own thing and they've been doing their own thing with that. Mm. You know, for example, I think all of us will have at least somebody in our life who they consistently have guilt around all food, like all consumption of food is bad. And, you know, maybe that is relating to their mental health through an eating disorder or perhaps it's not. But, you know, that kind of cycle that from the outside we can see is just sort of like self-confounding. It's just something that they're in a cycle of and likely they don't realize the extent of it even. And yeah, I literally say that and thinking how true that is to myself. But do you know what I mean? It's a weird thing to describe that you're not judging that person, but you can notice that thing and notice that it's not yours.
Yeah, like, oh, that impacted me. Huh. And to give yourself some space to recognize that. And then can you shift to some curiosity of, I wonder what made them say that? I wonder what has contributed to them seeing it that way? And trying truly to ask that question to be surprised by the answer, you know, as opposed to I'm asking the question to get them to see something, my way of understanding it, versus I'm asking the question because I genuinely don't know the answer for them. And I want to hear from their perspective, what is it about? So being able to, I think probably in between the two, take some deep breaths, get your body into a place where you can be genuinely open to whatever is going to come from it. And compassionate of, ooh, I don't know if that's even yours. Like, that's come from many generations, or that's come from our society at large. You know, I wonder if you'd be willing to explore that with me. Really incredible conversations have happened from that. And sometimes it's later. In the moment, you can't do it. But you can have the conversation later and say, hey, something's stuck with me that I've been wondering about, and bring it back up to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they may not even know the answer either. You know, why did you say that? I'm not really sure. Maybe it was something that was said to them.
Yeah, exactly. So then you're supporting them with their own growth. Then ideally, they're also not going to say that to you again and lead to your overwhelm. So it can serve both purposes, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Zooming back out again then, so looking at, you know, the kind of societal pressures, you've talked a little bit about, you know, how we deal with, I love the way you described it, the static around, you know, holiday expectations. What about, you know, the food side of that? Are there any things that we can do, you know, to look after ourselves when there is such this kind of human cycle of arguably in some ways binge eating being really endorsed mm-hmm. at one time, and then mm-hmm. the opposite, or, you know, mm-hmm. counteracting that with exercise and come January.
Yeah.
It can be a strange thing to feel yourself swimming in, and yet you might genuinely also be drawn to, well, I was thinking of starting yoga. Maybe I do start it now we've got the holiday over.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think the biggest thing is asking yourself, what do I need right now? You know, and so sometimes you catch it before you even start doing the activity, whether it's overeating or undereating, over-exercising, you know, all of these extremes, like getting to all or nothing. And so in those extremes, you can realize like, oh, there's something I need right now. It may be about food and moving your body. It may not be. It may be general stress or very specific acute stress. It may be, like we talked about, some of those other pressures, showing up well and the losses, or the what is this supposed to be? And you can, you know, like I kind of described in my early child experience, that idea of disconnecting, you know, we all dissociate to some extent. And that disconnection or dissociation is one word for that disconnection. So instead of really listening to what your body needs, what you emotionally need, you just do behaviors to try to soothe or meet that need. And that's not bad. That's human. And it's protective. It's trying to support you in some way. But can you get curious not only about the behavior, but about what is the need driving the behavior? What do you really want in that moment? And for some people, it's just some time alone during the holidays. Like, I just want to be by myself a little bit. Or my family set some boundaries around, like, Christmas morning, we do just my husband, my son, and I. We don't have anybody in the house. We're not in anybody else's house. We're just the three of us. And, you know, it's a very privileged thing to be able to do that with what we have in our family. But I do that for my own mental health and for my son and for my husband, for us to just connect to ourselves a little bit. And then that helps me stay more mindful throughout the day, so I don't disconnect, dissociate, just meet everybody else's needs. So that's kind of a larger meaning underneath the food stuff specifically. With the food stuff specifically, generally enjoy it, you know, find pleasure in it. And if you're getting to a point where you're disconnecting while eating or disconnecting while exercising, then that's something to be curious about. When did it teeter into that? And what do you need in that moment?
Wow. There you go. And if anyone's listening and wondering what person-centered counseling looks like, it's kind of every one of your answers. It's, you know, you encourage the client to check in with themselves and you go from there. And, you know, you take into account each person's history, their patterns, and then what, you know, what do they most need to work on? Yeah. So, yeah, I really appreciate you. You're clearly very good at what you do. And as we start to wrap up then, if people want to find more of your work, maybe if they're living near enough to even come join your practice.
Yeah. So I have two jobs. One of my jobs is with an organization called Eating Recovery Center and Pathlight Behavioral Health. And that's a hospital organization here in the States in a variety of cities. And we treat eating disorders as well as anxiety, depression, and trauma. And then my other job is I have my own private practice called East End Psychological Services. And that I do parent coaching and support parents. And then I also do clinical supervision. And I have started to work with psychedelic assisted psychotherapy as well, which could be a whole other podcast.
Well, yeah, you saw my eyes light up because it's very much a big conversation at the moment. We had a guest recently on to talk about that if people want to scroll back. For now, we'll wrap up. We might just touch on that behind the paywall in a minute. For now, sure. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.